the record button. And hi, my name is Jordy Izzard, and I am an alumni relations officer at SAIS, and today I'm here for our oral history program with Talbot Huey, who graduated from SAIS in the class of 1961. And today's date is April 14th, 2011, and we're so glad you're here with us. And we're just going to have a conversation and go down memory lane. So why don't we start with our first question, which is, what originally brought you to SAIS?
Well, I think SAIS was, for me, a kind of the culmination of a whole transformation of where I was going. And that was part of its real value, because in college, I had no conception of anything dealing with international relations or politics or history. I was a major in German literature, but that began a period of learning gradually a little more and a little more. When I was in the Army, I was thrust into an intelligence program which involved me in international relations and found it fascinating. So I went back and spent a year at the London School of Economics after I got out of the Army. Excuse me. Their approach was also very enlightened, but pretty theoretical. As you probably know, the British technique is to let you sit in on lectures and have you write little essays from time to time for your tutor, all of which is fine. I remember some of the lectures I took there very, very well, and some of them were outstanding. But gradually I was beginning to see what international relations was all about. But to come to SAIS was kind of the culmination of that, and was quite different from what I'd experienced in England. Because, as everybody knows, in those days, it was thought of as a very practical sort of place. It wasn't exactly training, but it was something which was trying to dip you into the real part of diplomacy, economics, maybe a little area studies, language, all of which was entirely new to me in that context, and very, very useful. Not only useful in terms of a career, of course it would be, I mean, that was sort of the point, after all, but in terms of your understanding of the world. And when I look back on it now, 50 years later, I just can't imagine how someone could go through life without getting that understanding, because it's so critical to making decisions about your own life, about your own politics, about where you live and what you do and so forth, because it is such an international and small world. I ended up living quite an international life, so SAIS was very much a part of the basis of that, but it was a unique and very, very valuable experience.
Mm-hmm. Great. And then in thinking about when you were at SAIS, tell us what some of your memories were of being here.
Well, of course, I remember some of the characters who taught us. There were the ones like Dr. Franklin teaching diplomatic history, some of the standard people. But I remember some others who were adjunct people mostly, and were very unusual and very, very helpful to me in everything. One was Helmut Sonnenfeld. He later went on to a glorious career as a sort of Kissinger protege in Treasury, I think, most of the time. But he was a tough guy and a careerist. And he would sit us down at the beginning of a class and say, now, I'm going to teach you how to clip the New York Times in your subject, and you're going to do this every day for the rest of your life. And we would shrink back, and he was absolutely right. He knew how to get us into the meat of things and the practice of things. Another one with an entirely different wavelength was Victor Sulam. He was an adjunct as well. He was actually Italian, and he was a consultant of various kinds of economics around Washington. And he was brilliant but tough. And I can remember very clearly one point our little class was discussing tariff barriers and currency barriers. He brought up the case of Spain. He said, suppose you're trying to move some money from Spain to France, and you have to cope with the tariff barriers and the financial barriers which they put up. What would you do? Well, total silence in the class, of course, waiting for him to give us some sort of a hint, some sort of an answer. Total silence continued for what seemed like a year or so. Finally, someone said something timid, which was wrong, but that's how he taught, and that's how things worked. And he was a very impressive guy himself, and he knew what to teach us, knew how to make us learn it. Of course, probably the biggest character of all was Paul Leinbarger. And I only took one course from him, which was, interestingly, a course in psychological warfare. Especially interesting because I got into that later on myself in an entirely different way. But what he did was entirely off the wall. he had written the book on psychological warfare because he'd been a Psywar officer in the Korean War and so forth. And he said, well, what we do in this course is you read the book and I talk about other things. And he spent at least, half the course talking about 57 different ways that you could analyze history. You could say the history for people was mostly a matter of their diet, or you could say history always revolved around the medical aspect of a particular nation, or something of that sort. And he would simply roll on class after class on this, telling us theories of history, essentially, which were much more fun and much more interesting, probably much more apropos than the nitty-gritty of Psy War. And so I remembered him as a guy who was unconventional enough and bold enough and brilliant enough to do something unconventional like that, which was very, very valuable indeed.
Mm-hmm. That's great.
Of course, he's always remembered as a great science fiction writer, too.
Yeah, that's true. That's great. Anything else while you were here?
Well, and those were the old Sais on Florida Avenue, and I think almost all of us lived in the neighborhood. Mm-hmm. I lived on P Street. I just checked this morning. I found that that house is now a veterinary clinic, passed on to a better incarnation, perhaps. But it's still very nice. And living in this neighborhood was an education in itself. But also, part of the lure of Sais and part of the value of Sais was simply being in Washington, so that you could not only enjoy Washington, but be part of what was going on in Washington, which was very much a part of your education here. So I remember just being active in Washington in life as well as everything mm-hmm. else. In fact, I'll tell you, again, this is very odd perhaps, I would be at Sais during the day and do homework and eat lunch or whatever you did. But every night about 11 o'clock, I would take a walk in the neighborhood. And sometimes that was quite an adventurous walk around DePaul Circle and into other places around the neighborhood. I can remember hearing odd screams and scuffles from time to time, being followed by people and so forth. So that was another introduction to the other side of Washington life, perhaps, as well.
Hmm. That's great. And when you graduated from Sais, I know you had a wonderful career, and I'd like to hear a little bit about how your career started. Tell us and take us through that.
Well, I think like most Sais graduates, what you're doing is gradually eliminating all the things that you might do until you get down to one thing. And when I got down to one thing, it turned out to be USIA, because I thought I could handle the cultural part, handle the informational part. These were all interests of mine, and it turned out to be good that I had chosen that in a way, but in another sense, it really didn't make any difference because I never did a conventional job for USIA. The first thing you do when you enter the agency as a junior officer is they ask you to tell your preferences for where you'd like to be assigned. Well, that's pretty much of a shock. I mean, you haven't even signed into the place. You haven't sworn in, but they want you to list your preferences. So I kind of listed them at random. It really didn't make much sense. The second thing they wanted you to do take a language aptitude test. Now, I had majored in language. I'd studied some other languages. And perhaps by chance, I maxed the test. Okay, I was the first person in USI to max the test. So the next thing they did was try to find the hardest language they could find to send me to. So they sent me to Vietnam as a result of that, which turned out to be, from my point of view, I mean, my personal point of view, a wonderful thing. It was part of an American experience or an adventure in Vietnam, which I think was totally flawed and eventually a total failure. But I have to say that when I was there, I enjoyed every minute of it and got a lot out of it and learned to be involved with Asia in a way which has followed me the rest of my life. So that turned out to be something kind of special. The first thing I did in Vietnam was assign down to a branch post in the Delta, where I immediately started to interview some people for an American Field Service trip to San Francisco, things that were pretty routine. And we had a 4th of July party in which the local dignitaries were invited and so forth. And then suddenly there was a war on. And suddenly there was no more USIS Saigon. There was just PAL, a joint U.S. public affairs office, which was mainly in charge of Psy War in connection with the Vietnamese and press relations in connection with the local reporters and media. And that's what went on for the next couple of years. And I was able to work in the countryside a lot, which was very exciting and very stimulating. Learned to respect the culture there very much and respect Asian civilization very much. And that also determined the trajectory of the rest of my life as well.
Mm-hmm. And what else? Tell us a little bit more about your career.
Well, I did 2 years in Vietnam, came mm-hmm. back to Washington, and they wanted me to do a Washington tour so I could prepare others to go to Vietnam. Mm-hmm. That eventually meant that I was sending scores and scores of somewhat reluctant USIS officers to Vietnam willy-nilly. I worked as a personnel officer for Asia at that point, and I think I must have sent 150 people to Vietnam over a period of a couple of years. I was also doing some lecturing around. I would go to Fort Bragg to try to tell the young officers that they should be thinking about hearts and minds and so forth, which was also fascinating, but even then I had a feeling that was a little bit an exercise in futility, because they certainly weren't interested, for one thing. Since I decided I was an Asianist, and since I was the personnel officer, at one point I assigned myself into Chinese training, mm-hmm. Which they started a new program, which I was able to go to George Washington University for a year, and then to Taiwan, to the State Department School for a year, which was very productive and very useful. And then I went to Hong Kong. Theoretically, it was just as an information officer, but actually, I was a China watcher. I ended up editing a semi-scholarly, semi-propaganda bulletin about mainland China, which I found totally fascinating, and which I think was able to do a pretty good job, because this was became a respected journal while I was there, called Current Scene. So I got very, very much into China. Kept up a Chinese specialty. But after 1968, when a lot of bad things happened, including a Tet Offensive, including some assassinations in America, including a more a closer look at Chiang Kai-shek's regime in Taiwan, I began to find that American foreign policy vis-a-vis the Far East lacked a great deal, let's say. So I simply said, I'm getting out. And I went back to MIT and got my PhD in political science, and then taught for a while, traveled for a while, librarian for a while.
Where did you get your PhD?
MIT.
Okay, great. And how did you like that?
Oh, that was fine. The thing about MIT is you also get Harvard while you're at it. So I was theoretically a kind of protege of Lucian Pai, who had done some good work in that field before. Some of his other proteges were Dick Solomon, who became Assistant Secretary, and so forth. But I paid much more attention, frankly, to some of the people at Harvard, and getting a blend of that was very, very useful. Mm-hmm. I wanted to stay in Boston, so I got a job at University of Massachusetts there. That was another whole long story, which I'll have to tell to the people at UMass someday. It was a battleground for 7 years between people who wanted to do certain things and other people who didn't want them to do it. So I was not unhappy to leave there. But the next phase of my career, if you could call it a career, was something that was totally unexpected and about which I knew nothing at the time, which turned out to be a wonderful thing, and that was the overseas program of the University of Maryland. University of Maryland decided it was going to be an international university by teaching overseas, focusing particularly on military bases. And they did it through a contract with, and still do it, through a contract with the Defense Department. So if you're a GI on an Army base in Korea, you can take university courses that are the same courses that they teach at College Park. So I taught in that program for several years, which was simply wonderful. The students were great, the context was great, everybody was serious. These were people who were self-selected, who wanted to get ahead. They had some discipline as a result of their military training, and they were terrific students. And if I can put it crudely, beyond that, there was no administrative bullshit, okay? Something which I'm sure people in academic fields find a lot and too much. When you were finished with your lecturing and you could meet with students, you were free. You were free to write a report, do some research, lie on the beach, go snorkeling, whatever you wanted to do. And then 4 or 5 months later, you would do the same thing in some entirely different part of Asia. This was totally fascinating to me, and I got a tremendous amount out of living there and working there and enjoying that a lot. But it's not something you can do forever. So there's never any question of tenure or anything of that sort in that program. So I decided I better get a daytime job. So I came back and got a library degree, at the University of Maryland, got an Asian job at Michigan State, and I worked there for 20 years.
As a librarian?
As a librarian.
That's great.
As the Asian librarian.
And tell us a little bit about that part of your career.
Well, the job is ideal in a way. The library is simply asking you to buy the books, to choose the materials in your field. And I had several fields, and it was a lark. It was a kind of a retirement, really, you know, just doing what you please. And they made sure you didn't make any money, but that was part of sort of the retirement anyway. And the university is a very good one, a very nice working atmosphere, a very good place, doing a lot of very interesting things. They're particularly interested in third world development. I was able to do some things about that as well, and it was a very, very good place to be.
Mm-hmm. So in looking at your career overall, what would you say was your favorite part?
Oh, I guess I'd have to say the overseas Maryland thing. It was just completely carefree, just amazing, and all of it stimulating.
Mm-hmm. And are you enjoying retirement?
Oh, yes, indeed. To contradict myself, I sometimes think, why didn't I do this 40 years ago? But apart from the obvious answer, I did enjoy my various careers, but it's really fun to be retired, too.
And what are you doing in your time now?
Very little.
That's great.
No, I'm actually volunteering at a National Historic Site outside of Maryland, outside of Baltimore, mm-hmm. Called Hampton, which is very interesting. You're certainly invited to come and take a tour sometime.
Mm-hmm.
And
thanks.
I'm doing a lot of exploring in Maryland. My wife is a fanatic kayaker, but I am not. So we go places, and she goes by water, and I go by land, exploring the local areas, which has been a lot of fun.
That's wonderful. Well, good. And then thinking about, you've had a vast number of experiences in your life and in your career, both before and at and after SAIS. And tell us a little bit in thinking about current students today, what advice you might have for them.
Well, they've already made the key decision, and that is to become international people. And I think that's the thing that they have to think about. The skills they learn at SAIS will be extremely useful too. But I'd also, even though I value the very practical education they receive here in any number of different ways, reflecting the realities of the international world today, that they would also try to think outside the box, think of something new to do in the international world besides go work for the World Bank or the State Department, something of that sort. One of the things I can think about, of course, is continuing in the academic world.
Mm-hmm. That's great. Well, we really appreciate your time today and really enjoyed hearing your life stories. And we'll look forward to seeing you again soon.
I enjoyed it very much. Thank you very much.
Thank you.